and welcome to The Wire, where you get independent coverage of current affairs on your local community radio station, wherever you are around Australia. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
China is stockpiling on coal, and they're also stockpiling on LNG cargoes because, you know, they're afraid that they're going to end up with a colder than expected winter.
We keep hearing how countries will be knocking out fossil fuels from their energy mix, and a lot of rhetoric about their meeting goals for 2050. Yet prices for coal, gas and oil are still on the way up. We have a look at what is really happening. Also on the program...
We need to expect that there will continue to be a number of cases amongst Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
As New South Wales and Victoria get to their 80% targets for vaccination, we are reminded that Indigenous people are still behind with only 36% fully vaccinated. We find out how this situation has been allowed to happen. Stay tuned for all this and more coming up on The Wire.
The Wire. Independent news and current affairs for the last 15 years and still going strong.
But first, Prime Minister Scott Morrison is going to the COP26 summit in Glasgow. The only question is, will the National Party give him a coherent policy to achieve net zero emissions by 2050? The federal government's current policy is to reduce emissions by 2030, with a supposed shift from non-renewable to renewable power to be the forefront of their strategy. Mark DiPoli has this story.
Scott Morrison is under pressure to commit Australia to a target of net zero emissions by 2050 before the United Nations annual climate change conference in Glasgow next month. The federal government are certain they will beat the current goal set for 2030 to have reduced emissions by 26 to 28% below 2005 levels. In fact, recent findings have suggested that Australia will be somewhere between 30 and 38% below those levels. According to Associate Professor Kate Crowley from the School of Social Sciences at the University of Tasmania and recipient of the Vice-Chancellor of Tasmania's Award for Outstanding Community Engagement on Climate Change and Sustainability, the federal government should be aiming much higher.
The suggestion that we'll meet our 2030 target easily just shows that the 2030 target is not a real target. 26 to 28% is well below the 60% that the Climate Change Authority recommended to the Australian government back in 2014. So for a start, our 2030 target's not even worth talking about. It should be at least double. And if you look at the state and territory levels, that's what they're adopting, closer to a 60% target.
The current 2030 target would see Australia emit 450 megatons of greenhouse gas emissions, down from the current amount of 500. Professor Andrew Blakers, director of the Australian National University's Centre for Sustainable Energy Systems, is not impressed with the Morrison government for not realising the potential to achieve better.
So this is grossly insufficient reductions over the next 10 years. We have to do much better than that. The new target should be below 300 megatons of emissions, and that puts us on track to getting down to about 100 megatons. That's the last 100 difficult megatons of emission reductions in the mid-2030s.
Some coal-fired power plants will begin to close in the coming years and we'll see emissions reduced by 1.2 to 1.5% if the plan to replace such with renewable sources follows through. The federal government predicted over half of Australia's power supply to be renewable by 2030. The New South Wales, Victoria, Australian Capital Territory and South Australian state governments all now have electrical vehicle policies and will see just under a fifth of all light vehicles by 2030 being powered by a non-combustion engine. However, Australia remains one of the only countries in the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development without national emissions standards. That goes without mentioning that federal policies indicate the intention to actually continue using fossil fuels, recently approving several new coal mines and expanded subsidised gas production. If the federal government were to aim higher with their 2030 targets, Professor Blakers suggests that not much needs to be changed, but alteration will have to occur.
The federal government doesn't have to do much. It just has to make sure that a national transmission network is implemented. This is new high voltage transmission to bring the new solar and wind farm energy to the cities. Then it just has to get out of the way. If it doesn't want to actually do much, just get that transmission constructed, get out of the way, and let private industry do what private industry is already doing, Just to put that in context, last year 7 gigawatts of new solar and wind was constructed. That's up from 1 gigawatt just 5 years ago. So private industry is leading the way. It can do the whole job provided it gets the support at crucial places, for example, in decongesting the electricity transmission network.
This may be difficult, though, as Associate Professor Crowley reminds. The Morrison government have not been quick to change climate policy during their time in power.
So the Morrison government's been really careful since it's come to power not to introduce new policies because Malcolm Turnbull was dumped for trying to act on emissions reduction.
They have also not been met with widespread support. Nationals leader Barnaby Joyce has been very vocal in warning that reaching climate goals sooner would be a waste. Associate Professor Crowley hopes that the Morrison government ignore his complaints.
I think you could say that that's just grasping at anything to throw in the way of any sort of effective action. You've got to remember Barnaby Joyce has been around obstructing climate change action since the time before last that Malcolm Turnbull was rolled as opposition leader by Tony Abbott.
Past federal governments have struggled to move Australia out of a very judgmental international eye. The Morrison government have been no different. Just yesterday, a mock billboard of the Prime Minister bearing the title Coalophile Dundee Goes to Glasgow was seen in Times Square. If the federal government want to begin to shift this perception, Associate Professor Crowley wants to hear something far more positive when the PM touches back down on Australian shores sometime later next month.
Well, the best outcome coming back from Glasgow that the Prime Minister could do is to just say, OK, the political football that is climate change is now being put away and we are now going to treat this as the economic issue and the transition issue that it is.
Associate Professor Kate Crowley of the School of Social Sciences at the University of Tasmania, ending that report from Mark DePolly.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
The federal government is seeking to overturn a High Court decision that deemed Aboriginal Australians to not be aliens and therefore could not be deported. The current federal case of Shane Paul Montgomery, a New Zealand man identifying as Aboriginal, brings the outcome of this ruling into question. James Murray has more.
The High Court's ruling in the Love and Toms case in February of last year saw that Aboriginal people with sufficient connection to traditional societies cannot be aliens, giving them a special status in Australian constitutional law. The current federal case of Shane Paul Montgomery seeks to extend this status to people customarily adopted as Aboriginal, even if they have no biological Aboriginal relation. Montgomery, a New Zealand man, identifies and has been recognised by elders as a member of the Mununjali people. Emeritus Professor Helen Irving of Sydney University speaks to the potential outcomes of the Montgomery case.
The High Court could say the Love and Toms decision stands, but it doesn't apply to Mr. Montgomery because he doesn't satisfy the three-part test for Aboriginality. Or the High Court might say that the Love and Toms case stands and it applies to Mr. Montgomery as well. Or the High Court could, it's unlikely, I think, but it's possible, the High Court could say, yes, we will overrule the Love and Toms decision from last year. In that event, what it means is there isn't any longer that category of non-citizen, non-alien that applies to Aboriginal Australians. Persons who are not Australian, say not Australian citizens, who are aliens, they would become identified all as aliens and they would be susceptible to the cancellation of their visa or deportation and deportation can follow from the cancellation of a residency visa.
Dr. Shireen Morris of the Macquarie Law School explains the unique nature of the Love and Toms case in its ability to deem alien status among Aboriginal people.
The majority of the High Court said that Indigenous people, as understood according to the three-part test that was set out in the Mabo decision in the 90s, are not within the reach of the alien's power. But what was significant and different about the decision, I think, was that the majority drew upon common law recognition of native title and ideas like that to acknowledge what they termed the deeper truth, that Indigenous people as the first peoples of the country carry a unique spiritual or metaphysical connection with the Australian continent, right? So that there's this deeper connection that's older than the Constitution and that therefore influences the meaning of alienage under the Constitution. And that, that's why Indigenous people could not be considered aliens and accordingly could not be deported, even if they're not Australian citizens.
A distinction between the Montgomery case and the Love and Toms ruling is that there are now two new justices on the High Court, being Simon Stewart and Jacqueline Gleeson, taking the seats of two of the justices who voted in favour of the initial ruling. Dr. Morris comments on how this new composition could impact future decisions.
Justice Stewart began his stint by declaring in the recent Liberty Works case that the implied freedom of political communication, which has been established precedent for a long time now, he said it doesn't exist, and he seemed to encourage a challenge to question the case law on that topic. So, you know, I've seen some writing about that saying, well, that comment shows that he's the most black-letter judge on the bench since Dyson Heydon. I think it's an interesting comment. I think, ironically, it's sort of a bit activist in its conservatism because it disregards and invites challenge to established precedent, which in a way increases legal uncertainty. But what it underscores is the fact that decisions that rely a lot on judicial implication are not set in stone, that they rely on judicial interpretations, and those interpretations can evolve and change over time. So it will be really interesting to see whether the two new additions to the High Court do bring about more changes.
Dr. Morris continues to suggest practical steps the government could take regarding Indigenous citizenship.
Love and Toms, and presumably Shane Montgomery as well, would not be facing deportation if they had obtained Australian citizenship. So I think the government should actually be proactive and encourage Indigenous non-citizens, given the High Court's finding of an important ancient connection with this continent that Indigenous people carry. Government should encourage Indigenous non-citizens to apply for citizenship, possibly by making the citizenship processes easier, waiving or discounting fees, and maybe even including indigeneity as a positive factor in the Migration Act that should weigh in favour of citizenship applications. So, you know, rather than taking an adversarial approach, I think there's an opportunity for government to implement some positive, practical policy changes to help Indigenous non-citizens become Australian citizens.
Dr. Shireen Morris, Senior Lecturer at Macquarie Law School, ending that report from James Murray.
Hey there, we're the Warren Miller Band and you're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
With New South Wales and Victoria announcing relaxed restrictions, there are concerns that unvaccinated Indigenous Australians will be left exposed to the virus. Currently, only 36% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people across Australia over the age of 12 are fully vaccinated. Ricky Kirby asked Dr. Jason Agostino, a medical advisor and epidemiologist at the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, why Indigenous vaccine rates are so much lower than for the general population.
Up until June, it was hard to access Pfizer for many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. Till that time, you can only get it in Pfizer hubs, which were, you know, in large cities and weren't doing outreach into communities. And it wasn't really until we saw Pfizer get into Aboriginal health services and other general practices that we saw those numbers really rise. What we're dealing with now is really about some complacency with people not understanding how hard Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities have already been hit by COVID in New South Wales and Victoria and ACT, as well as misinformation campaigns that have targeted Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And, you know, the result of that is that we continue to see low vaccination rates outside of the pandemic areas and particularly in the under 40 population.
How do you think the early easing of restrictions in New South Wales and Victoria will affect Indigenous communities?
We need to expect that there will continue to be a high number of cases amongst Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. Even during the lockdown, the rate of infections was almost twice that of non-Indigenous Australians. So with the restrictions easing and lower vaccination coverage, I think we're going to continue to see those numbers to rise over the next few weeks.
Why are Indigenous people at more risk to COVID-19 than the general population?
There's two reasons. The first is that there's a higher risk of spread. Part of that is due to crowded housing, and with, you know, many people living under the one roof, and Delta spreads particularly within households. The second is that many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have the chronic conditions that put you at risk for severe disease. So, you know, ending up in hospital or in ICU or dying. So things like diabetes and heart disease. And many people have the onset of those conditions at young ages. So there's sort of this two things going on, increased risk of rapid spread as well as higher risk of severe disease. And our other focus is just making sure people have access to testing and also access to the new treatments that make a big difference in terms of severity of disease.
How do you think the government can better respond to vaccine hesitancy of Indigenous communities?
You know, the main thing is to support the people on the ground, the people within the community, to talk to those that are hesitant and understand their concerns and bring them around. I think people imagine that some ad campaign will magically disappear all this hesitancy, and that's not what's going to happen. What we see is that it's hard work going door to door, listening to people, being respectful of what they're worried about and what concerns they have, and addressing those concerns. And so when we've been doing that, that's when we see many people come around. And so it's about supporting communities to do that sort of hard work to address hesitancy.
What is your message to Indigenous communities regarding COVID-19?
So it's hitting the community hard, and it has a real big impact on the whole community because of lockdowns, because of people going into hospital without their loved ones. And the main way to stop it from hitting the community hard is through vaccination. And we really need people under the age of 40 to come forward and get vaccinated in really high numbers, because the population's young. That's where most people age group is. And they're the people that risk going to spread COVID, just how they move around. So we need that group to get vaccinated. If you ever do get something like a cold, it's really important that you get tested as soon as possible. You know, many of our Aboriginal health services have testing machines that can give you a result within an hour. And because testing means that you can isolate quicker, and it also gives you access to some treatments that we can give now that can decrease your chances of ending up in hospital, which is really important. So get vaccinated, but in the meantime, if you do get cold, get tested quickly.
Dr. Jason Agostino, medical advisor and epidemiologist at the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation, speaking there with Ricky Kirby.
Whenever I want to catch up with current affairs in Australia, I head to thewire.org.au or I follow them on Twitter. I just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. And yes, they're on Facebook too.
Across the world, demand for energy is on the rise. Oil prices are booming as economic output returns to pre-pandemic levels, coal prices are hitting record highs, and a gas shortage in Europe is placing serious pressure on supply. This is amounting to a ferocious appetite for fossil fuels, creating windfalls for the Australian minerals sector. Newcastle coal prices are up 250%. So what's behind these changes? And what impact is this likely to have on the Australian energy market? Evan Wallace spoke with Dr. Lurian DeMello from Macquarie University to find out what's driving this change.
If you've had to refuel your car recently, you might have noticed that your wallet felt a bit lighter than normal. According to Lurian de Mello, this is one part of a new international energy crisis that is shaping international markets.
Hi, my name's Lurian de Mello. I'm a senior lecturer in applied finance at Macquarie Business School.
For Lurian, this crisis is being driven by demand for multiple energy sources. In the case of oil, this stems from countries bouncing back from the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic.
The crisis is kind of spread across three commodities at the moment. With the crude oil, it's mostly from the increase in demand that's taking place with economies opening up, and also the OPEC and OPEC plus countries are unable to provide the supply that's required.
When looking at surging coal prices, it's a more complex situation. Fearing a colder winter and extra demand for energy, major Asian economies such as India and China have moved to increase their coal stockpiles.
China is stockpiling on coal. They're also stockpiling on LNG cargoes because, you know, they're afraid that they're going to end up with a colder than expected winter. We saw a winter and an electricity sort of crisis taking place in Japan over last winter. So I guess everyone is afraid that, you know, the cold temperatures would have some sort of an impact.
In Europe, countries are being plagued by a gas shortage.
There's also supply issues of gas coming into Germany, for example. We have the gas that's coming from Russia is not coming to as expected capacity as the Germans would like. There are issues in the UK with their gas supplies because there's been a windless summer in the UK. They've required to, you know, use more gas for their electricity generation. So there are various factors at play at the moment.
I asked Lurian what sort of impact these energy dynamics might have on Australia. And from an Australian perspective, what implications do you think this energy crisis could have for Australia? What might it look like in reality?
Australians are probably going to face higher fuel costs. That's the biggest problem. Thankfully, we don't have a gas crisis as yet. We have to keep in mind that most of our gas is exported to Asia, and, you know, companies are benefiting from that with the prices going up. So I guess the biggest worry for Australia is, you know, higher fuel costs. Given that the eastern part of Australia is slowly opening up, we've already seen, you know, the petrol prices in Brisbane, which has had less restrictions, being the highest in the country. So I think, you know, if the oil price continues to move upwards, we're going to see further increases in fuel costs.
It all makes for a very complex situation as demand for fossil fuels skyrockets while international leaders meet at the Glasgow Climate Summit with the hope of reducing global carbon emissions. How do you see current trends and this dynamic affecting discussions over the next couple of weeks as world leaders do meet in Glasgow?
We've been trying to move away from coal for many, many years. You know, over the last 30 years, you know, some countries like the UK produces 0% electricity from coal. So they've managed to successfully move away from coal. So I think it might not be beneficial for the UK, for example, to suddenly start stockpiling, you know, coal reserves. For China, I mean, China has around 303 coal-fired power stations. And it's the lifeline pretty much of the Chinese economy in terms of energy for electricity or whether it's energy, you know, used to produce steel. The transition phase is not going to happen so soon. I mean, it's going to take a while. These are the kind of teething sort of issues I think governments need to resolve before they actually go and spend millions and billions of dollars or pounds trying to move further into solar and wind.
Dr. Lurian de Mello, Senior Lecturer in Applied Finance at Macquarie University, speaking there with Evan Wallace. And that's it for us from The Wire today. You can find all of our stories on at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney and broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.
be the place for creatives.
I didn't know you did anything creative.
Because when you subscribe to 2SER for Radiothon 2021, you can choose to go into the draw for the Makers and Creators prize pack. It's got a Rode mic and interface, wireless go-to mics, a gorgeous electric acoustic Fender Porter guitar and accessories, courtesy of Downtown Music, and two cases of beer from the Atomic Beer Project. Subscribe and choose your prize pack now at 2SER.com.
I will go on a white beach. You were next to me and you told me I'd never seen you look so happy. And I told you I was thinking the same thing too. I was thinking the same thing too. Watch as the loving jelly play. Watch as the time pulls a candle.
You know, our love's kind of like something.